big right-hander gets ready. Oh, almost a wild pitch. A great save by Brad Ausmus. That's what he must have majored in at Dartmouth, stopping would-be wild pitches.
Well, that was quite an effort. Jamie Navarro's still around. And I'm kind of surprised that Cedeno is as deep as he is at shortstop, because on a chopper, he's got no chance of coming home with it. They've got to go second to first, and a chopper scores the run. That's a most unusual defensive alignment in this situation.
All righty. Fouled it off. He's lucky he did. He's way off stride on that one. Mark was fooled by the pitch, but he tapped it foul. Sam, you made the shirt too long. Cubs win! Cubs win! Cubs win! Cubs win! Holy cow! Mark Grace came through with a single to left, and the Cubs have won the season's opener before a capacity crowd of almost 39,000 paid.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap. And Mike Donahue is with us as always. Mike, how are you? You're frozen. That's how Mike is. Mike's frozen. So I'm sure he'll be back in a second. But it's a perfect time for me to tell you that, as always, the Pointless Exercise Podcast is brought to you by Manscaped. Summer's coming and hotter days are just around the corner. Keep cool with the help of our friends at Manscaped, who just launched their fourth generation performance package, which includes the Lawnmower 4.0. You heard that right, the 4.0. Complement your summer grooming routine with a trim from the leaders in male grooming. The sun is shining and calling your name, fellas. Join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped. And get ready for summer by going to manscaped.com for 20% off and free shipping with the code REMEMBER20. It's time to bundle up the Manscaped Performance Package 4.0. Inside this package, you'll find the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer, weed whacker, ear and nose trimmer, crop preserver, ball deodorant, crop reviver toner, performance boxer briefs, and a travel bag. We didn't get a travel bag. And a travel bag to hold your goodies. I don't want to know what goodies they want to put in that bag.
Try not to laugh during a live read, you know. Keep it professional. That's but I was very excited to receive what I will just sort of deem an early Father's Day gift from the fine folks at Manscaped. In addition to the Lawnmower 4.0, which they had sent a month ago, very excited to use the Weed Whacker, because in my advanced old Irish guy years, I'm finding the need to really keep my nostrils clear.
Well, let me tell you about the Weed Whacker. The Weed Whacker is also waterproof and uses a 9,000 RPM motor.
Yes.
Motor-powered 360-degree rotary dual-blade system. This nose and ear hair trimmer provides proprietary skin-safe technology, which helps prevent nicks, snags, and tugs.
And then, of course, I'm holding the one that I might be most excited about, of course, is the Crop Shaver, only because... I'm very slow to convert to electronic trimming. I like the natural feel, whether it's my face or my head or my balls, of not having any stubble whatsoever. And I know that can be a tricky proposition when you go down there to have a blade, but I've become, as Steve Stone would say, I've got the hands of a sturgeon. But I've been safe so far. But the Crop Shaver, this you know, handy little just straight, you know, razor blade that it seems easily contoured. Very successful this morning. My boys are still there and very, very clean. So kudos to the folks in the R&D for the Crop Shaver.
I'm never going to find it anything but odd that you're more comfortable with a real razor
I'm telling you.
With an electric one.
Smooth as a baby's bottom, as I rub the top of my head.
So, get 20% off and free shipping with the code REMEMBER20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code REMEMBER20 at manscaped.com. Stay fresh this summer and shine with Manscaped. So, it's time to spin the wheel of crap and see what we're going to be talking about for the next 90 minutes or so. Are you ready?
Yep. I'm ready.
Well, look at it go. It's very exciting. Oh. We're stuck in the 90s.
Still in the 90s. Might as well just relabel this. Might just have two separate shows. Go ahead.
1996. That's today's season of crap. So, five quick things about the 1996 Cubs.
Happy to do it. The astonishing return of Ryne Sandberg on opening day 1996. And on that very same opening day, former subject of Remember This Crap, much discussed in the early episodes, Jaime Navarro took the ball on opening day against the Padres in a game which also happened to be Ricky Henderson's first appearance in Wrigley Field at the ripe old age of, I don't know, late 30s. I'll have a story for my time in the bleachers and you know, engaging with Mr. Henderson at that point. Fact number three, I'm going to stay on opening day. We were referenced this guy before, in addition to all of the litany of Cub young closers that they've developed, like Lee Smith and, you know, Bruce Sutter and Bill Connell. You know, there are other guys that came through town at the other end of the tunnel, like Goose Gossage, one guy that fits that ladder profile. I mean, Dave Smith was another, but another one would be Doug Jones, who blew the save on opening day. And eventually lost his job to Turk Wendell. 1996 was the Cubs were alive somewhat, faintly, not really, not one of those real seasons, but there was a season in St. Louis in which we saw the last, the death rattle of Ozzie Smith and Ryne Sandberg, who both had huge hits, but the Cardinals swept the Cubs, and the Cubs ended up losing about 14 of their last 16 games in that season. And the only other fact that I'm going to throw out here at the beginning, obscure as though it may be, the writing might have been on the wall for longtime 90s curly-haired third baseman Steve Buschel, as he was the Cubs had introduced some competition for him in the form of Leo Gomez, about whom one Michael Donahue was particularly optimistic about heading into the season, which just kind of shows you how tortured we were at that point in time. So, the 1996 Cubs, folks. Yet another Tribune production mediocrity by design in the 96 Cubs. We're very much in that range.
Yeah, so on September 13th, the Cubs were 74-72, five games out. I don't know where they were in the wild card race.
Which was new, yep.
They managed to lose 15 of their last 17.
I was off by a game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all the names of the guys that beat them, it's an illustrious group. Mims, idea, Philadelphia. Kurt Schilling, Donovan Osborne, Todd Stottlemyre. The Cardinals had a Bailey. This was not Homer.
God, I wonder who that would have been.
Francisco Cordova.
Oh. I remember Francisco Cordova.
Dave Burba. Dan Plesac got him.
Plesac well, after he had pitched with the Cubs.
Yes.
Wow.
Got him twice. Twice in the last weekend.
He got two wins or two saves against them?
No, wins.
He vultured two wins.
Yeah. And the season ended with Jaime Navarro going down to a good friend and drug trafficker, Steve Loaiza. Esteban Loaiza.
That's right.
So, yeah, the Cubs were, they had a winning record at home, 43-38. They were 33-48 on the road. They were 16-11 in June, 14-12 in July, 15-13 in August, and then 9-19 in September.
They tanked. It was, 1996 for me personally, there are certain years that resonate. 1984, which we'll talk about in the context of the Cubs. You know, like my last year of innocence, I was 12 years old. The Cubs surprised everybody with the playoffs. 1988, I remember I started driving, and there's a certain year. 1996 was exciting. because we'd been out of school a short while, and I had gotten enough money saved up to where I was able to live in an apartment with a roommate at, off the intersection of Southport and Grace, which was about three blocks from Wrigley Field. We moved in February. I was 24, making a little bit of money, and of course, the main motivation, even though I had a job all the way out in the southwest suburbs, I was way out in Westmont, Illinois, which is like west of 294, south of 35th Street, okay? So really counterintuitive. It was a reverse commute.
You'd have been better off staying in DeKalb than driving there.
Exactly.
I'm reverse commuting.
Let me just say that oftentimes on Fridays coming home, I learned all of those Southside Angle Roads, your Ogden Avenue, Plainfield Road, Joliet Road, whatever, like every 22nd Street, cutting through Berwyn. I mean, it was just, it was a torturous pilgrimage. Nevertheless, I was committed to living within blocks of Wrigley Field, regardless of where I worked, because I was going to spend every ounce of available free time at 1060 West Addison, and I probably went to more games in 96. I wasn't even a season ticket holder. I was invited to have a share of tickets beginning the next year, but in that first year is probably where I went to the most games ever, probably over 30. Went to the opener, of course. There's only my second opener, coincidentally.
Opener is, for some reason, one of Marquis's favorite games to replay.
Woo! Really?
I know it was a walk-off win, right? It was Grace, I think, got the win.
It was Mark Grace. After Doug Jones had blown it, yes.
And I believe they show it because it's the return of Ryan Sandberg. But in hindsight, no one is excited about that. Not even Ryan.
Well, in hindsight, right?
The return It was a wet turd of a return. He was there, right? But he wasn't Ryan Sandberg anymore.
He was.
It's kind of like it's exactly like Jake Arrieta's back. He's not Jake Arrieta. He's just some clown in a bad beard and a shaved head who used to be awesome. And I just prefer to think of Jake first time, and I'm going to expunge this one from my memory. It was with Sandberg.
You're absolutely right. At the time, you know, I remember, you and I have talked about it. I think we give Sandberg his proper due. I mean, he's absolutely phenomenal. It was a privilege to watch him. Some people might think we were quick to, you know, laugh at his shortcomings. But at the end of the day, I remember how much I hoped that, you know, I was excited about it. There was a sort of a parallel track to Michael Jordan, right? They both wore 23. They're both Hall of Fame players. Jordan retired, came back to a rousing success, huge second act.
Right.
He quit in 93, came back in 95. Sandberg quit in 94, came back, and even admitted in his biography, which he had time to write in between during the retirement with Joseph A. Reeves, known under his byline as Joey Reeves, that, you know, he was, among other things, you know, a little bit inspired by Jordan's comeback and tried to make a go of it. And it was just, remember, just like, well, he hit 25 homers, didn't he? He hit like 25 homers, but he batted .244. And he didn't have the range. He was not the same second baseman. The best thing about Sandberg coming back, as much as for a lot of us that lived it, and in retrospect may have sullied his reputation, it did one absolutely noble thing, and it allowed him the opportunity to surpass Joe Morgan as the all-time leader for home runs hit by a second baseman. That alone makes it worth
it. And I think if we look at why Joe hated him so much, that's why. I think Joe felt like when Sandberg retired, his record was safe, even though Jeff Kent would have obliterated it eventually anyway.
But we all know Jeff Kent couldn't move sideways without falling over, he's not even in the discussion.
He didn't play second base. He manned second base.
Correct.
Yes. Go stand over there, Jeff.
But you're right, and he played the steroid era. Joe
had 2 years where to him, he's like, oh, my record's safe. Nobody's going to break it. And then all of a sudden, that son of a bitch came back, and he's hated him ever since. Well, I mean,
that's a great theory. There's probably some truth to that. Meanwhile, Joe Morgan, who like breaks into the league in like 1965, just plays long enough where some of those counting stats look more impressive than they might be. Resents a guy going out it's not really on top, but regardless, kudos to Ryan for that. So, but yeah, he did come back on that opener. It was my second opener. Coincidentally, my first was discussed last week, which was just a tale of debauchery from DeKalb to Chicago and back to DeKalb. In 96, I was living three blocks away, took the day off work, of course, because that's what you do when you're single and 24. You burn up your days to go to Wrigley Field. Went with a group of people. I was excited. We were in the left field. Ricky Henderson's there. I'm stoked. Hey, hot dog. Ricky turns around. And as soon as I said, welcome to the National League. And then Ricky was pretty good. He sort of pretended to slather himself in hot dog, you know. And it was exciting. He was already a Hall of Fame player. It's amazing that Henderson played for another 5 years, but he'd never played in the National League until, and this is an era, of course, this is the last era of non-interleague play, but this was the there were there are generations of ball players like Ted Williams and, you know, a butt for high school, Lou Gehrig, George Brett, Robin Yount, never played at Wrigley Field. And Henderson would have been in that camp, but until he came over to the Padres, for the first time after being with, you know, only like three American League teams, but he was with the A's on three different occasions and Yankees and Blue Jays. So, but yeah, there was Ricky and,
So Ricky would eventually play for the Mets, where it turns out, it was very disappointing to find out the story was not true.
John Olerud?
Yes, but it was one of the great ones. Whoever told it deserves it to be true, and that was that he saw John Olerud taking ground balls with a batting helmet on, went over to him and said, "Hey, I played with a dude in Toronto who did that." And John goes, "Yeah, Ricky, it was me." That was a great story, but then John goes, hilarious, but it never happened. Right. He goes, but it's exactly something that would have happened to Ricky. There was a long time where Ricky only referred to himself as Ricky. It was never me or I, it was always Ricky.
Okay.
He was classic. The inspiration for the, I don't remember, the Leon Sandcastle commercial.
That's Pusateri, the ad campaign.
Or not Leon, no, commercial. Sorry, not the Leon Sandcastle one. There's another Leon one. Do you remember the guy who, I'll find the commercial and drop it in because I just love it. It's a Bud Light commercial, I think. And it's just this arrogant wide receiver being interviewed after the game.
As wide receivers.
And they're talking to him about how many passes he dropped and how many times he fumbled. And, it was like, I can't do it justice. But his line is, Leon can't do everything.
Nice.
That was Ricky. So Ricky, it would have been, I'm sure, probably in his second Oakland. I'm trying to think what year this was that we did this. So I played infield basically my whole little league and high school career. But one year I had an accident. I fell off my bike.
and Steve Trout, huh?
And I tore it. Yeah, well, mine wasn't a stationary bike, unlike Steve's. mine was rolling. I got my bag stuck in the wheel, went over the handlebars, caught myself on the and cut up my hands pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And so I had to wear, for the first couple of games, I had this like basically open wound on my throwing hand. So they put me from third base, they put me in left field. And they figured it'd be less action for me out there. And so I'm out in left field. And before the game, I think I spent 2 weeks in left field because lots of fun stuff happened. The center fielder on our team was left-handed, and I bat left-handed, but I'm right-handed. And
you bat left. So do I. You bat left-handed and you're right-handed.
I do.
Cool. Hey, good for you.
So we are playing catch before the game, and we decided to swap gloves. So we're playing catch with the opposite hands in the outfield. Pretty good, I will say. Not you, Darvish, good, but pretty good.
All
right. So then we gave the gloves back, and then while the coaches were hitting us balls, I was trying the Ricky Henderson snatch catch.
Well, he kind of swipes it like this, right?
You catch it. You literally, as the ball is about head high, you sweep your hand in front of your face and snatch the ball.
For those of you that can't visualize, it's sort of like when you get the fuck out of here, like the back of the hand, or my dad will do it if the Cubs ground into a double play.
So I thought it was super fun, and our coach basically gave me the nice catch, Hayes, don't fucking do it again. I was, 13, first fly ball to me in left field. I caught it that way. But I caught it. I also, this also sounds made up, like a Ricky Henderson thing, I threw two guys out at home plate in the game.
Wow.
My debut in left field. I had more fun. I never wanted to come back. I hated third base in the first place. I didn't want to go back, and they made me go back. I went back.
Check out Dave Parker over
there. We also had a game where in the last inning, I may have played left field left-handed.
Wow.
Yes.
Look at you, a regular Bill Lee or Jimmy Pearsall out there.
My dad had noticed that. He would have kicked my ass.
Sure.
But I was ready. So. If the ball had come to me, I would have caught it with the wrong hand.
So I actually
he scored
went
again.
Another drunken scorecard, and all the way to the ninth inning. You can see, I don't know if you can see, Ricky Henderson was leading off. So I still have that in my collection because I sure as hell would have otherwise had a difficult time remembering. I do have a memory of, like, in the drunken afternoon, like, getting close to sunset, sort of shadows, where after Doug Jones had blown the opening game, that Grace, good old Mark Grace, who at this point was really sort of peak Grace, I think, for the Cubs. He had sort of restored the early promise of his career. He would go on to have a nice season in 96, I'm fairly confident. But he sent us home happy when he bounced one into right field to drive home the winning run.
Ryan Sandberg's return seasons to the Cubs. He was 36 years old when he came back in 96. He'd only missed 1 year. He missed a year and a half. But he really didn't, because he didn't miss a full season, technically.
Neither season was a 162-game
season.
Right, because
the 94 season ended early and the 95 season started late. Yep. And we talked about this when we did 93, right?
94, last one.
Oh, just 2 weeks ago we did 94?
Uh-huh.
I'm still stuck in Jerry Morales and
still
Manny Trio.
That's right. We did the special edition with Frank in 1977. I forgot. Yes.
So, because in 93 he'd been really good. 309, 359, 412. I mean, not really good, but good, especially for a 33-year-old second baseman.
That's right.
And then he had crashed to earth in 94. He came back. So in 96, he hit 244. 316 on base and a 444 slug. So only the slug is acceptable of the three. And that's still not that great. But 25 homers. He drove in 92 RBIs. That's RBIs are more a function of the guys in front of you.
The team, it was a decent offense, I think.
And then in 97, that was a fun year.
His average went up. But...
Yeah, he hit 20 points better, but he was worse. He had 264, but his on base dropped to 308 and his slugging dropped to 403. He hit 12 homers, drove in 64, and that's the year he should have quit early, but he didn't. He stuck around for the whole thing.
Well, you know what? Poor Rhino, though. I mean, his last two seasons were 94 and 97. We've covered both seasons, kids.
You do feel bad for him because part of why he came back was the 95 Cubs had inexplicably contended.
Yes, and he wrote about that in that biography I referred to that he wrote with Reese, that he showed up in the bleachers. He probably almost cracked a smile for the first time, but like he wrote about sitting with the fans, and Jordan had come back, and like the Cubs were like miraculously in a pennant, you know, in a playoff chase down the stretch, and that kind of, hey, maybe I do have one more. Maybe this team's not so these shitbags that I walked away from 14 months ago. I wasn't going to deal with it anymore. Dealt with it enough in and out in the 80s. And hey, they might be well positioned for me. So he comes back sort of under the
95 Cubs had gone for it and had traded for superstar Todd Zeal.
That's right. I was at Zeal's first game, by the way.
I should know this. 95. Is that the last Cub Cardinal trade? Have they traded?
Oh, I'm sure
they
have.
I don't know.
Are you joking? Is this one of those ones where I'm missing an obvious one?
No, I don't. They don't.
Have they not made a trade? I don't know offhand, but I can't imagine that's true. That'd be incredible.
I mean, it's not every day you can fleece Mike Jorgensen. I don't remember who the hell that guy was.
Is it? So I was going through my score. I don't know if we want to. We can always come back to Sandberg. But one other thing, I don't have a scorecard for us, but I went to a game in early May. Pull this one up because it was great. First Friday in May, Dallas Green was the manager of the Mets. Took another day off of work. I convinced Oleg to take a day off work. Got my dad, who was already retired, to come down. Three of us sat in the bleachers. And we watched Navarro totally out, totally duel. It was a great pitcher's duel. Back in 96, it was probably would have been a barely two-hour game. Who was it? Paul Wilson? I get Paul Wilson and Paul Gibson. It's the guy that Farnsworth 7 years later would body slam
Paul Wilson
in Cincinnati.
He was one of generation Mets.
the big three, Jason Isringhausen, right? And shit, the Bill Pulsifer,
yeah,
right?
Bill Pulsifer.
They were the big three.
Yeah.
The other two had decent careers. Wilson, not quite so much. In this particular game, Wilson completely had the Cubs handcuffed.
Wilson was the best one.
He was. Really?
But he was always hurt, and so he never okay. He had the least productive career. But he was the most talented of the three.
So we mentioned in 94, I'd kind of discovered. This wasn't one of those things that I had sort of hardwired into my brain, that what a uniquely fine season Sammy Sosa had in 94. And you might not have caught it because he was streaky and he, you know, sometimes played for himself and knew it. He batted 300. He landed on 300 and he had another season in 96 that probably proved that it wasn't a fluke. We'll get to the point where on September 1st, I said last time August 1st, but it was September 1st when he got hit on the wrist by Mark Haughton of Florida, but he had 40 homers at that point. 96 to me was really the season that Sosa started to really turn the corner to be a really good all-around hitter and not just a boom-bust guy. But what's funny is that in early May, he still kind of was that streaky ball player. And he was coming into this game, he was like 0 for 15 or something like that. Friday afternoon, unusually warm day, or nice warm day in May. It's not always a promise, especially the first weekend in May, that it'll be temperate, you know, nice weather. Game's going by pretty snappy. I don't remember if it was 2-1 or 1-0. Like I said, it was the first Friday in May. In the ninth, Brian McCray, in his second year with the Cubs, and he was still pretty, you know, helpful before he really bottomed out in 97. He got on base, and then he got a double, or he moved to second at some point. And it was I think the Cubs were only up by one. And Dallas Green, God bless Dallas Green, but poor guy was kind of at this point just riding it out, managing the Mets. He's like in his, like his third or fourth season. He made the decision to put Grace on base, which I believe was the winning run, to face Sosa, who had been like 0 for his last 18. Sammy was struggling. And at this point in his career, he was still sort of a, you know, he didn't really, you know, he was streaky. He had produced where, you know, he's going to be a longtime player, but how great will he be? And he proceeded to deposit Wilson through a complete game. The last pitch of the game he throws, and Sosa just, you know, we were in right field. It was just, you know, euphoria. Sosa got a hold of it, broke the 0 for 18 streak, delivers a lead-changing walk-off homer. We're jubilant. It was fantastic. You know, go to the Crown Lounge on Southport afterward, have, you know, celebrating it. 2 days later, in a tie game in the ninth inning, in the bottom of the ninth, Sosa comes up and hits another walk-off home. Not a lead-changing, but a tie-breaking walk-off homer. And this ball flew on a fly into the first floor window in the yellow brick building on Waveland Avenue and shattered the window. Some engineer from Europe was living in that building at the time he was interviewed. It was just incredible. And I was living two blocks away down in Southport. I'd only been living there 3 months. It's May 3rd. I've already been to like seven Cubs games. But it was, you know, it was exciting. It was, you know, this was a team that was over 500, and really it was sort of like the emergence of like, I think at that point, he probably still earned the reputation of maybe being a guy that put up numbers when it didn't matter. Although that's always probably a bullshit thing, because over the course of it, it's not true. Sosa proved it's far from fucking true by the end of his career, because the guy had so many huge hits and huge home runs.
Ask Ugeth Urbina. He'll tell you.
Fucking A, right? And it got in that stage. So I don't recall him doing a bunch of that, though. There was probably some where he could compile the stats. Part of the reason he became a 30-30 guy and happened to draw criticism from Ron Santa was getting caught stealing in September in games in 93 when he was clear he was trying to get 30-30, which, you know, rubs teammates and stuff the wrong way. But you can do what he did that weekend. You know, I felt like Sosa had really started to arrive. Like he kind of stopped laying off, like breaking shit in the dirt that our friend Sean Dunstan never learned to. By 92 years later, he was actually hitting homers off of guys like Maddox and stuff. So a fun season in general. As we go through it, probably Sammy's name is going to come up again. But that weekend in May, it just felt like he had really sort of arrived, and he was really, you know, really kind of taking it to that next level.
Okay, so the Cubs have made not one but two trades with the Cardinals since. Since the great trade, it was Todd Zeal and cash.
Let me guess.
To the Cubs.
No, I'm not going to guess. I'm not going to guess.
Francisco Morales, Paul Torres, and Mike Morgan.
And Mike Morgan.
That was their. Okay. That was the first trade the teams had made since December 9th, 1980, You know,
Ken
Reitz,
your buddy Ken Reitz, the yes. Bruce Sutter trade.
Yes.
And Leon Durham.
Leon Durham came and over. Ken Reitz, the Cardinals sent, or the Cardinals sent Ty Waller to complete,
okay.
to complete the trade.
Ty Waller was the opening day center fielder in 1982, my friend.
The trade before that they made was just a year before, and it was Mike Tyson for Donnie Moore.
The white Mike Tyson. Donnie Moore. Okay. All right.
But
wow.
The 2 cents
so
are huge.
Between 1980 and they didn't make a trade for,
nope,
15 years.
Years.
And of course, from today is, of course, now, what, 26 years ago?
Yes.
And they've only made two in that time.
They have not traded with the Cardinals since the 4th of July, 2007.
It hadn't occurred to me that this was a thing. 4th of July, 2007. Why would they trade with each other? They were both in contention in August.
It was a huge deal. It's the deal that the Cardinals regret it to this day because it swung the division towards the Cubs. They traded John Nelson to the Cubs as part of a conditional deal. I don't know. Sounds like John ran out of options and ended up on the Cubs. The trade before that, though, is one
what's the year?
Ended up helping. Did he pitch all right for the Cardinals? I think he did. August 25th, 2002, the Cubs, hopelessly out of it, traded the troll, Jeff Fusaro, to the Cardinals for Jared Blaisdell and Jason Carnuth, which both sound made up.
Yep.
So not a lot of trades between the two, and it's going to be a long fucking time before those two make another trade.
It never occurred to me that they don't trade. Is that just a Cubs-Cardinals thing? The Cubs not trade with the Reds?
Well, you tend to not trade with...
That's true.
...teams in your division if you're both
right,
contending.
And unlike the Pirates, who want to give you Randall Simon and Ramos Ramirez in separate trades.
Yes. In fact, I'm sure I'm sure everyone in the division will be are already calling the Pirates for their two useful players. I don't even know. Adam Frazier, and there's got to be somebody
else. Frazier's one for sure.
So doing that. Okay, so another Mark Grace. I had to look this up. He hit 331.
Yeah.
There's
Pete Grace in 96.
So what do you
win a Gold Glove?
Where do you think in the batting title race in the National League in 1996, where do you think 331 landed, John?
96 was the Ken Caminiti Rookie of the Year, or not rookie, MVP season. Was it 331? Was it worse than fifth?
It was fifth.
It was fifth. Wow.
Tony Gwynn won the batting title. No, you know, no shock there. 353.
Yep.
Ellis Burks playing for the Rockies, so with a big asterisk. 344. Mike Piazza at 336. And future Cub. This one will literally shock you. Howard Johnson hit 333.
After he was with the Cubs, I would never have guessed that. I felt like he was like washed up when he was with the Cubs. That was 95. He'd already had his long career. He had a 30-30 season along with Strawberry and the Mets.
Wait a minute.
Who the? Was that it, can't be right.
Was it? It can't. Wasn't Lance? No. Who Johnson was it?
Okay. 1996. There's no way it's Howard Johnson. No fucking way. He was on his last leg of the Cubs.
All right. Well, like 125. This is why it's remember this crap, not research this crap.
Correct, but we do research within it just to set the record straight.
Johnson. It was the one dog. It was Lance.
Wow. Fourth in the National League.
I wouldn't have thought. I didn't think of that at all.
With who?
With the Mets. He hit.
Oh, because he was traded to the Cubs like in September of the following year.
Yes. I had no. I blocked that out. So, yeah, Lance Johnson.
That's incredible.
I mean, I guess he qualified for the batting title. He batted 682 times.
Wow.
227 hits.
Wow. What
he had 333, 362, 479. Good. That's a huge year. Good Lord.
Wow.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know what I was, like Johnson.
Well, you
Mets.
Saw Johnson
gotta
Mets.
Got to be Ho-Ho.
No. Yeah, Ho-Ho kind of was done by the early 90s.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, of course you played for the Mets.
Who knew
that was the blockbuster post, like
yes,
mystifying post waiver,
the greatest post waiver trade of all time, the trade that hurt both teams. And
but you know what, Andy, in 1996, Brian McCrae was still useful. I don't have any stories from Brian McCrae in 1996, but I'm just going to point out that he did something unusual. He was a switch hitter, but when he batted against Tom Glavine, who was a left-hander, McCrae batted left-handed.
Yeah, it was very smart because Glavine struggled against lefties because he wouldn't throw his changeup to him. You eliminated Glavin's changeup if you batted left-handed. So it made perfect sense.
Smart.
He was still smart, good. Smart. So it didn't really help that much, but it certainly didn't hurt your chances. That and the fact that, you know, the Glavin and Maddox got to their strike zone, their plate was, 28 inches wide or whatever. Not that I complained when Greggy was a Cub. That was fine.
Well, yeah, depending on how much it may have been a thing. That's something that probably deserves a deeper analysis somewhere.
Wow.
And also how it bit them in the ass against Levon Hernandez.
Coming off of a weekend in which the Cubs thoroughly outclassed the Cardinals, and yet Yadi repeatedly stole strikes way off of both sides of the plate. It's amazing. Yes. Umps are just like, oh, that's got to be a strike. It's like, no, he's been doing it for 18 years. You know that's not a fucking strike. Stop it.
Maybe that might be the only argument to put him in the Hall of Fame is that he managed to trick umpires.
He's a blatant cheater. Screw him.
Who would have been the Cubs catchers in 1996, right? We still we had dealt Rick Wilkins. Oh, Scott Service.
Scotty Service was the catcher.
Who had a huge lead-changing game-winning home run early in the season in Coors Field. I recall that one of the few Scott Service moments I remember, the other being driving in a run in the NLCS against the Braves in 98, which would have been the game-winner had Javi Lopez not homered off of Kevin Tampany.
Now, I don't know. That concludes. I don't know what year. I remember this happened. I just don't know. I have no idea what year. Do you remember the play where Scott Service was involved in a collision at home plate, hung onto the ball, tagged the runner out, threw down to second, and got a runner trying to advance because it looked like he had died behind home plate.
Like a immediately post-concussed.
He separated his throwing shoulder. He threw a guy out at second base with a separated shoulder.
If he did it at all,
nobody ever doubted how tough Scott Service was. Might not have been that good, but he certainly was tough.
No, he wasn't. He was like a typical catcher. Is he still the manager of the? I mean, I wish him well, only because he was on the '98 Cubs, and as awful as he was as an offensive player, but not that much more awful than a standard catcher. He did, like I said, have an RBI single, an unlikely RBI single in a playoff game that Tappany couldn't hold up.
I believe Scotty still. The Mariners are terrible, but that's kind of halfway by design. I believe he's going to hang on to that job for a little while. 1996 Cub infield. Is it the best Cub infield of all time? Mark Grace, Ryan Sandberg, Ray Sanchez, and Leo Gomez. It's up there. Leo Gomez. I know you mentioned it before, but
I know
he looked like a Leo Gomez.
I don't even know what he looked like. I just remember I was tired of Steve Buschel for some reason. I mean, fine, you gave us a third baseman for more than two seasons, and he wasn't awful. And it's not that I hate mullets, but can we spice it up? And somehow I convinced myself going into the season that Leo Gomez, coming over from Baltimore, was the piece they needed. And so I cheered whenever he would get more playing time over Buschel. They kind of split the duties that year. Now I'm looking at it now. Actually, Leo was pretty much the everyday third baseman. I don't know.
Yeah, 124 games.
But a 735 OPS.
He played more games than Sammy did because Sammy broke his hand.
Sammy broke his wrist. And he never played again after that season, which
Leo Gomez went out on top.
Raises some eyebrows. The only Leo Gomez memory I have, and I don't even think it would be worth trying to find, was I believe he drew a bases-loaded walk, a walk-off walk in a game at Wrigley. Oh, okay. Harry was going crazy. We still had Harry in 96, by the way, but it was really, it was his penultimate season.
Yeah, it was getting rough. The guy who shared third base with Leo Gomez, former Met,
was Buschel totally gone? Was
Lou
he totally
Pinella's
gone?
Nephew? Is that what his cousin? He's Lou Pinella's cousin, longtime batting coach Dave Magadan.
Oh yeah, right. Which if you're from Chicago, you're like, wait, why is it not Madigan? Because there's I'm only saying it because there's Mike Madigan, Speaker of the House. There's Charles. Right, I know, but like, how did those Irish people? It must have been the same name. Like, where did whoever heard of Madigan or Magadan before? And by the way, I apologize.
Probably an Ellis Island thing.
I somehow thought the Cubs held on to Buschel going into '96. They cut him loose, thank God, coming in. So you're right. The third, the hot the hot corner was being manned by the Leo Gomez Dave Magadan combo. And how can you go wrong when you got, you know, Magadan was like a singles hitting, contact hitting, left handed pinch hitter guy for the Mets in the '80s, right? He may have been on their 86 team. I always didn't like him because he was a Met early on. No, he was not on the 86 team, but he played a little bit more later on.
So these 96 Cubs, they weren't just a bunch of pretty faces. There were the pipeline that Jim Hendry had been building. Jim Hendry, Dave Wilder, and
was Hendry part of the? Oh yeah, he's a scouting director. Yes. In 96.
His pipeline of talent was oozing talent. Immortal Cubs: Scott Bullitt, Ozzie Timmons, and Robin Jennings all played. Brant Brown made his big league debut. Mike Hubbard caught 17 games behind the plate. And, Brian Dorsett was the 35-year-old.
The only thing I'm going to say in defense of, and I can't believe I'm going to defend Andy McPhail and Ed Lynch for anything. First of all, I'm going to assume that they must have brought Jim Hendry in. But just because I do this every week.
Did he come from the Marlins?
Yes. So they may have hired him. I do this every week, just sort of try to provide this sort of historical context to indicate what was going on at the time, you know, with the franchise. And we've had met several of these seasons, which I always characterize with this mediocrity by design, this second phase of Tribune ownership that began in 92 and lasted all the way until they sold the team to, to Sam Zell, that they were already on their second regime, because Larry Himes was sort of what ushered in this, but Larry Himes only lasted three seasons. 94 was so bad they had to get rid of him. So I will say, in defense of these clowns who proved to be clowns in subsequent years, the whole, you know, McPhail, Lynch, Hendry, whatever you want to call them, this was only their second season. All right, their second draft. So some of these guys you name weren't necessarily guys that they drafted.
Yeah, they're not real Hendry guys.
Not real Hendry guys, not real Lynch, you know, McPhail. I mean, the first draft was 95 where they got Wood. The 96, but, you know, it didn't speak much more highly of them. I know that in the amateur draft, their first pick was Todd Noel, who, even though they managed to trade, get Felix Heredia,
they got the run fairy for him.
The majors.
So what do you think Jim Hendry's job was before he came to the Cubs in 1995?
Was it the Creighton Blue Jays manager? Picture Jim Hendry just wearing the baseball uniform.
Well, he was a manager. He was a 38-year-old strapping manager in the New York Penn League at Elmira.
Oh, Elmira. The minor league team from which I want to say famed umpire novel or umpire writer chronicler Ron Luciano, who had a lot of famous run-ins with Earl Weaver, apparently once threw out of both games of a doubleheader in Elmira.
Let's see who he managed. What notable players he managed on the 1994 Elmira Pioneers. They went 30-43.
You got to tell me who they're a subsidiary of if I'm going to make an educated guess, Andy. The 1994 Elmira?
Florida Marlins.
Oh, okay. But they would have been below the Appleton Foxes, who in that very season I saw Alex Rodriguez play for them.
Yes, New York Penn League is short season, so it's younger guys.
So it's not even a real – Jesus.
No, they only played 73 games.
Charles Johnson was probably already on his way through. Would have been like Ryan Dempster. Was he on that fucking team? Would have been guys that started emerging with the Marlins in 98, 99.
There were four future big leaguers on the team, none of whom were any good. So he didn't have a lot of talent to work with. One of them was famous, though, because he had given up a college football scholarship to play quarterback.
Josh Booty.
But he only played four games for Elmira. He had a double. Ryan Jackson, does he do anything for you?
No.
He hit .290 for them. John Roscoe's.
Nope.
Hit .279 and one pitcher, Rob Stanifer.
Nope. Maybe.
So not a lot of
So before Booty went to LSU to cash in on that scholarship after he had exhausted his opportunity to play in baseball, because I saw him not at the game where I saw Alex Rodriguez, but I went to another game in King County that summer of 94. And I know I don't have the scorecard, but I know this happened. I wouldn't have known Josh Booty from Adam. So how else would I remember this other than the guy's last name was Booty, but he went 0-for-4 and had four strikeouts. So, right, so it wasn't a shock to see
the year before that was Jim's other professional baseball managing team. He managed the The Gulf Coast League Marlins. That's a rookie league team. And this team did have guys you've heard of.
Well, it would have had A-Rod probably after he got drafted, no? Did he have A-Rod?
A-Rod? No, these are Marlins.
But it's a Marlins affiliate. I'm sorry, 93? You're talking about 1993?
Yeah, not Alex Rod, not Alex Rodriguez, not the Mariners, the Marlins.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jesus Christ. My bad.
There are one, two, three, four future Cubs on this team. So, and he traded for them all. Brett Barbary. Actually, it's Chuck Carr, not a future Cub, but Chucky Carr. You remember Chucky Carr?
I remember Chuck Carr.
Future Cub Dunwoody. Todd Dunwoody. And yep. Pitchers, oh, a couple of greats. Felix Heredia. And Will Kinane.
I remember Will Kinane.
Yeah, Will Kinane.
Wow.
Will, as much as I make fun of Yachty for looking like the banjo playing kid from Deliverance, and rest in peace, Ned Beatty. Will Kinane actually looked like the kid. One of the creepiest looking big leaguers ever. Take my word for it. Folks at home, pull over the car and Google.
I'm going to Will Kinane. I'm going to do it right now.
Yes.
He pitched for the Cubs, right?
Or he did.
I don't even remember what he looks like.
It's like the droopy eyes. There's just something. There's something wrong. One of his Padres pictures is just, it's disturbing.
Oh, it kind of looks like Martin Short doing that SNL character where they're in the synchronized swimming and he's like, I can't.
That's right.
I can't swim.
I'm not a strong swimmer. Got the life vest on.
He does that Padres picture.
Yeah, Will Kinane.
I'm going to leave it
so
at that.
So that informs a lot of Jim's moves.
I had no idea.
I had him in Kissimmee.
So somehow Andy McPhail and Ed Lynch plucked Jim Hendry from the field. He was just a field manager, right, for these snot-nosed 20-year-olds?
Yeah, I would guess, though, if you're managing, like, rookie league and like, short season, you're basically in player development, even though you're a manager.
That's right. You're not really a manager. That's right. Okay. And so he was the farm director. But he definitely came in, came in with the McPhail regime, obviously. I'm assuming. Was he the farm director in 95 then? I'm looking myself, so I can answer that question. No, it was still our guy, Al Golis.
Oh, yeah, it didn't happen until after,
Well, Golis was the old regime. Mm-hmm. So Hendry was their scouting director. Yeah. That was their guy that would yield, you know, such notables as, I don't know. John Garland was not a bad draft pick. We've talked, Corey Patterson was not a bad draft pick. It was how they developed him that was the problem. Ben Christensen may have been a bad draft pick. So you got to weigh that.
Great value, though. Incredible value. You're never going to get a guy that. I wonder if you think he would have drafted the child molester from Oregon State if he was still around. I know the kid's kid's got some baggage, but. Woo! You should see the way you throw a curveball. Like, no, we're not. Sorry, Jim. We're not doing that.
Yep.
Jim Hendry, in the brief interactions I've had with him in my life, is just a super cool guy.
I know.
You really wish he had won. They had won a World Series there.
I agree.
When he was there. He was.
He's a
baseball guy.
Yeah, he spent some time at one of the shitty OKs when we were all, you know, pretty plowed, but still upright.
That was one of my favorite nights because I told Crane Kennedy to go fuck himself.
That's right. And that was.
I was ahead of the game, too. I knew to tell Crane to go fuck himself a long time before most people knew to tell Crane to go fuck himself.
That's true. But, of course, it was still about an hour or two after our late, great friend Jim Flannery, rest in peace, gave, as a season ticket holder, gave Crane quite an earful.
Yes, he did.
It must have made them regret walking into the bar that night. Then, did you have the Toby Ricketts? I think that was the convention right after the Ricketts had purchased the Cubs. So to me, in my memory, it was one of the last ones where we hung out.
Yeah, that timing works. It had to be. If it wasn't, it had to be the one before they bought it.
Or you or Jeremy, I think, may have had Toby Rick or Toby. Somebody pretended somebody. Yeah, a make believe brother. I think you had the Todd Ricketts or something. I don't know. We were up to no good. But yeah, Henry still deigned to like put in some genuine times with sincerity and. He always struck me as a good guy. You put it on the head. I mean, you really wanted him to do well. He was not a fucking asshole. He just didn't do it.
Well, I mean, he built a team good enough to win the World Series, and they just didn't do it.
Which happens because, there's only one winner at the end of the year. So, lots got to go right, as we've learned.
Yes.
Yeah, I just had a random name pop into my head on the 96 Cubs. Do you remember, and I'm not even looking at their roster yet. I will in a minute. But do you remember Terry Shumpert?
Of course.
I was at another Padres game.
Terry Shumpert.
I was at another Padres, because this is back when the AL NL West teams would come to town twice. And I happened, of course, like I said, I was any of my free time was being spent at Wrigley. So I was in the bleachers again for a Padres series later in the year. And our good friend Terry Shumpert hit a walk-off homer. I think it was on a Thursday night because Ricky, I was heckling Ricky pretty good that game as well. Terry had a couple big homers, but
Terry is a guy who he played for a long time and had one inexplicably good year. He played, and I mean, it had a lot to do with where it was. He played 14 seasons, and out of
did
nowhere.
Did he really?
Yeah, and out of nowhere in 1999, playing part-time. He's basically played half the games. He hit .347 for the Rockies. 10 homers, 37 RBIs.
Wow.
He never hit high. Well, he hit .289 a couple years later. But he was a career .252 hitter who hit .347 one season. So.
Wow. Yeah, I'm looking at his line now. Very undistinguished career, but the fact that he played 14 seasons is not a thing that I would have guessed.
Just imagine, Bob Nightingale would have loved to have tweeted out the day he got his 10 years of service.
Oh, is that a,
remember
is
see that,
a,
weird
is that a,
thing? It's when they guys qualify for their pension. And so the Players Association makes a big deal out of it, and Nightingale always tweets that out. Hey, congratulations to whoever. It's like, no, Bob, no, none of the fans give a shit. I mean, the guy's wife cares. He cares. Nobody else cares. Knock it off.
Boob.
Yeah, weirdo.
You know, it just occurred to me, you know who would probably love this podcast the last few weeks would be Steve Traxel, because we talked about the last, I'm not including 1970.
Was this one of his every other years? Let's see.
Right. Because the last episode we did, Frank Nova not included, was his rookie year in 94, and he was good. He was the mythical bullshit Sporting News National League rookie pitcher of the year. And then he sucked in 95, and then 96. I think it was just the Steve Traxel's one all-star season, right? Or maybe that was later. Maybe that was 98, because 98 was good too.
This was an undeniably good season for. It was his one All Star season. He was 13-9 with a 3.03 ERA, 181 hits and 205 innings.
Yeah, it was good.
Let's see what he was at the All Star break. Maybe that's. Maybe he was 12-1 at the All Star break and went 1-8 after. I don't know. He probably didn't.
Right. Right. But even then, Navarro was pretty much the eighth. They actually had a really competent rotation.
Honestly, you on this current Cub team, you would take the 96 Cub rotation and plunk it
at least
there,
the top
and
two.
And you'd be better than what you are.
I am looking at the roster now. There is a drop off. First of all, Frank Castillo, moment of silence. He really started dropping off in 96. I shouldn't look at one loss, but his ERA was 5.28.
Yeah,
so Frank, we covered the 92 Cubs where young Frank
Trevor
was
Williams.
He was a very formidable number three behind Maddox and Mike Morgan as a untested rookie, showed his mettle. So I think we had high hopes, but by 96, the bloom was off the rose, and he was traded shortly after winning that car from Brian McCray the next season. And then you had Bullinger, and then here's a name. I'm sure you've seen it, but who can ever forget Amore Telemaco?
Oh, I loved Amore Telemaco, future Philly.
Yeah. Yes, he made his debut, I think, that year. And then Kevin Foster, who I was always partial to. I think that was the year in which he was nursing a two-run lead against the Giants in an afternoon game in San Fran and surrendered a lead-changing go-ahead homer, three-run homer off of Barry Bonds. Mm-hmm. Wasn't meant to be. So, yeah, top two, Navarro and Traxel. Who are the Cubs' top two? Hendricks and, is it
Davies? It's Adbert when he's healthy.
Yes.
Davies when he's not.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
so
it's a comparable rotation.
Yeah, Steve That's Traxel, he made the All-Star game on the strength of his first half ERA. He was 7-5 with a 2.14 ERA in 16 starts. He'd thrown two shutouts. Second half, he was 6-4, but his ERA ballooned to 4.05.
Not bad.
So, yeah, good. It was a good year. 3.03 ERA for the season. It's pretty good.
Due for a regression. So, yeah, that's what made Traxel so frustrating, because he was, he had stuff. I mean, that and, of course, his up and down seasons and his ability to, turn a 2-hour game into a, Godfather marathon.
Yeah, looking at here, you would not take the 96 rotation. That was
just the top two, though.
Yeah, because not bad. Castillo, Bullinger, Telemaco, and Foster.
No. I'll always, and I've mentioned it before, but I'll always remember Jaime Navarro fondly for putting two of his best seasons together for the Cubs before absolutely shitting the Cubs while stealing Uncle Jerry's money. Based upon what he did for the Cubs, that's how he earned that money, resurrected his career, after showing an early flash in Milwaukee and then bottoming out and getting an opportunity at the Cubs to show what he had. He had two really good seasons for us. He was the opening day starter, and he pretty much lived up to it all year for I would say the 96 Cubs were mediocre. They may have been very, very slightly above mediocre. I mean, you look at the lineup. I mean, there was, Grace Sandberg was washed up. Grace and Sosa.
Jaime had an interesting career, given that a guy from Bayamon, Puerto Rico, played his entire career in Milwaukee, Chicago, and then 7 games in Cleveland. Like, Jaime, there's teams in cities where the sun actually shines. Go back.
You should hear Jaime's Midwestern impression.
Now that so he's got it down. There's a lot of black ink on Jaime's stat sheet, and none of it's really very good. So he led. If you don't know, black ink means he led the league. He led the league in '98 for the White Sox in losses with 16.
Love it.
He had lost 14 the year before. He lost 13 the year after that.
I love it.
With the Sox, he was 25-43. He was basically James Shields.
He remains the reason, or maybe Shields maybe snapped the streak, but I feel like he was the reason that Uncle Jerry waddled downstairs to demand, whether it was Ron Shuler or whomever, Kenny Williams, to not give free agent pitchers any long-term deal. I feel like it was Jaime Navarro's contract going all Dave Smith or Danny Jackson on the White Sox pretty much set their course. Until, of course, Shields, like you said, the Sox traded for Shields. I'm sorry, it was the Padres that dabbled in and overbid on Shields and then quickly corrected it.
Yeah, and then got Fernando Tatis Jr. for their trouble. I think they're pretty happy with that.
I'm sorry, who?
Jaime also led the league. His last year with the Cubs, he led the league in hits allowed, 244. Followed that up by doing it again for the White Sox, 267. He led the league twice in earned runs allowed, once with the Brewers.
With the Sox.
He led the league his first two seasons with the White Sox. He led the league both years in wild pitches. His last year with the Cubs, he led the league in batters faced with 1,007. He was 29-18 for the Cubs.
Yep.
And for the rest of his career, then, he went 17-25-49.
Wow. God bless him.
Included his immortal final season, in which he made 12 starts, 5 for the Brewers, 7 for the Indians, and went 0-6 with a 10.53 ERA.
If I was a White Sox fan, I would, my eyes would twitch every time I heard the mention of Jaime Navarro.
Yeah. Talk about, because the Cubs literally squeezed every bit of good baseball out of him and then let him move on.
It was
money.
Great. And he got paid. He got paid. So, he got paid for the work he did. He was just really, he was their best pitcher. And, for a mediocre team, so it didn't go anywhere. But, gave us a good effort. He was fine for us.
So, do you know who led the 96 Cubs in saves? It was not Doug Jones.
I'm going to say it was Turk. I think I mentioned that Wendell assumed the role. Yeah, I think it was Wendell,
it was
right?
Yes, he had 18 saves.
So, around that time, this would be like the post-Randy Myers era. Myers' last season was 95, and so Doug Jones was their solution going in. And I think even then, I remember then, thinking – bullshit. Doug Jones is like 86.
He was 39 years old.
Yeah. Like, all right. So right.
And he threw 39 miles an hour. Oh, this is a great idea.
And it was. It wasn't like a Dave Smith free agent. Dave Smith broke the bank. It was because of the Dave Smith that Tribune was in this sort of shooting for the middle. Where, yeah, let's try to get this guy in the cheap. And so I remember thinking. And I probably bought into the hype because I think, you know, you're still kind of into the narrative. Boy, it'd be a lot of fun if this weird freak with the necklace, Turk Wendell, can actually be our closer. So I was kind of rooting for that. But also at the same time, around mid-95, a rare Jim Fry draft pick sort of shot up, suddenly shot up through the farm system after so many years. It was Terry Adams.
Yeah.
And so this fireballer, it's like he's blowing him away in Des Moines. And Adams fared okay in 95. So I remember thinking, like, Wendell should be the guy short-term, but Adams is going to be the closer long-term. It's not going to be Jones. And they gave up on that, unlike Don Zimmer. Once they realized Jones was fucking finished, I don't think he was even in that situation come May. And Wendell was, which is cool. But I remember just hoping, like, grabbing the rosary beads for Terry Adams. Like, let that be the guy. He's got the arm. He's got to be our homegrown closer. And you know what? Terry Adams actually pitched for the Cubs longer than you might think, because I remember he was on the 98 team walking in runs and shit. But he just never quite put it together. He did have a good arm, though. I swear to you.
So Doug Jones had been a five-time All-Star. He'd had in 94 with the Phillies, he had had a 2.17 ERA and 27 saves.
Wait, hold on a sec. The Phillies in 1994 were defending National League champions. Is it like, are you telling me that after Mitch Williams gave up that home run to Joe Carter, that they didn't even want to have him come back? Was that, did they get rid of him after that?
Well, I don't know. Let's see.
I mean, not to have you go down a rabbit hole, but that stuck out like a sore thumb to me. The 94 Phillies were defending National League pennant winners who happened to have a closer, which, you know. Interesting.
Yeah, Mitch Williams did not pitch for the 1994 Phillies.
They had to get rid of him because all those shitheads in Philadelphia mostly were like burned down his house in the offseason. Oh, Schilling hung him out to dry. Was that right?
Well, Schilling, remember in the playoffs?
Putting his head in the towel.
Yeah, with his fucking head in the towel.
Fucking dramatic bitch.
So Doug had not been good, though, the year before with the Orioles.
He's a strike short. Okay.
Yeah, maybe that's their thinking, it's a short season. He was 0-4 with a 5.01 ERA, 55 hits and 46 innings. The Cubs are like, yeah, this will work. They brought him in. They released him on June 15th. He caught on with the Brewers.
And he did well after that.
24 games, he was 5-0 with a 3.41 ERA, but they didn't use him as a closer. He had one save.
Okay.
And then, so he pitched. He was 39 when the Cubs got him. He pitched 1-2. He pitched four more seasons. He finished up at 43 years old in Oakland. On the 2000 A's, he was 4-2 with a 3.93 ERA and two saves in 73 innings.
That's a Forrest Gump-like career. He touched the early Billy Bean era A's. He was kind of like a Rod Beck, right? He was a closer with a mustache that didn't throw that hard. I think that was his deal.
Yeah, he intentionally didn't throw hard. Rod didn't throw hard because he couldn't anymore. But he was still, his arm was still moving as fast as it was.
I do kind of remember Beck being a little bit more of a fireballer for the 93 Giants. But yeah, Jones, what a cheap ass solution at closer. But like, what do you have here? It's almost like, you know, we talked earlier with this year's Cubs before they kind of gelled in the last 3 or 4 weeks, where they were a little bit top heavy, where they got some talent at the top and then no depth. It kind of feels like this team. I'm just looking at the roster. It's like, you got Mark Grace and Sammy Sosa, you know, Brian McCray, a way pre-steroid Luis Gonzalez, you know, an old Ryan Sandberg. It really drops off. And then same with the pitchers. Jaime Navarro was very effective. Steve Traxel up and coming, and then it just drops. Like, there's no depth.
No.
There's some good players which kind of fit that Tribune model, right? Especially with Grace. Grace was in his peak, like I said at the beginning tonight, in a really fine season. He's 32. He's pretty much, you know, God knows, you know, how many, you know, just what his nightlife was like at that point. But he was earning it all. But it was, it was just a oddly constructed team.
Yeah, Grace had 181 hits, 39 doubles, only 9 homers. But it also only struck out 41 times in 616 plate appearances.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, 851 OPS for a guy that didn't hit a lot of homers.
The primary backup catcher was Tyler Houston, who had come over from the Braves, where he had been a top prospect.
First round draft pick. One of those drafts that we covered.
In 46 games, he hit .339 with a .382 on base average and a .452 slug. And they're like, "Oh, this guy, like this guy's good." And then they played him more next year and went, "No, this guy's not." Ah, shit.
Right. In answer to the meatballs, why didn't that Jim Riggleman put that Dallas Houston in for Scott Service? That might have been me, actually, because Scott Service would sometimes frustrate me. Although, you know, a 7.11 OPS is a lot higher than I would have thought for Scott Service in 1996. So good for him.
So did Tyler Houston ever play for the Astros?
I don't think so.
Because he could have played for the name on the front and the back of his jersey had he done that.
Yes. Good call. And just scrolling through, too, I think I would you would be remiss if we didn't mention that. We did.
What, Dave Schwarzbaugh?
It was a pitcher. The Rockford.
Yes.
The pride of Rockford
East's very own Rodney Myers. Well, not to be confused with Randy Myers.
I'm going
to
tell the story again. Because he was on the 97 Cubs, too. But his three-year, highly successful year with the Cubs. And then he goes on to free agency and almost pitches the Orioles into the World Series. And then the next year shows up, and there's another Myers. And I remember my brother asking me, there's Myers on the Cubs, but it's not Randy Myers? No, it's Rodney Myers.
It's Rodney. Almost.
But you explained the mystery to me, because I would see, like, I thought I was hallucinating.
There would be fans in the stands with
Myers
jerseys?
Why are there people wearing Rodney Myers number 59 jerseys?
Yeah,
I had no idea that he was
55 miles to the
guy.
North and the West. Yes. That's why.
He's a Rockfordian.
Yes, he had groupies.
Probably so, right. Well, but there, I would see it like I said, 1996 is like the summer that Huey's living.
Was he good old number 59? Yep.
I thought he was. I might be wrong. But I'm living right on Southport. I'm in the city. I'm a man about town, Andy. I'm going to 30 Cubs games. I'm eating at Striganona, whatever. And I'm seeing people in Rodney Myers jerseys, and I'm just going, what the fuck? But now it makes sense.
Yeah, Rodney pitched 4 seasons for the Cubs, and then 3 for the Padres and 2 for the Dodgers.
Okay. He had a good career. He didn't get the Boob Nightingale pension, though. But
no, he came close. 9 seasons.
Oh, shit.
I don't know how close he got. Those couple of those are his last 2 seasons with the Dodgers, a grand total of 5 appearances. So I don't think his service time was as close to 10 as you might think. He did have... No, I thought he had a good year with the Padres. He didn't really. He had 5.32 and a 5.91 ERA. His best season was 99 with the Cubs. 3-1 with a 4.38 ERA.
Wow. So he pitched with the Cubs for 4 seasons. Or maybe, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't pitch. He only pitched 17 times in 97-98 combined. But he made 45 appearances in 96 and 46 in 99. So he spent a lot of time in the minor leagues. Lots.
Like a lot of members of the 96.
Another former great Cub, just by the name alone, Tanyan Sturts.
So wasn't he a future White Sox? Didn't he not finally make it to the show with the Sox? You're right. It was an unusual name that you'd sort of like hold on to because you'd hear it like talked about a little bit.
He pitched parts of 2 seasons for the Sox, a grand total of 11 appearances. But he went to the Rays and pitched quite a bit for them.
I see some black ink.
He made 27. He made 60 starts for the 01 and 02 Rays. Yeah, and led the league in losses in 2002. He's 4-18. That that's a huge year. He led the league in losses, hits, earned runs, walks, and that's the triple crown right there, right? Hits, earned runs, and walks. He didn't lead the league in home runs allowed, but I'm sure if he gave up 33, so it wasn't for lack of trying.
That's incredible. He actually made quite a contribution to our great game, as Ron Coomer would call it, our game. Good for Tanyan Sturts. Wow.
And he pitched for the he pitched 3 years for the Yankees. Did not win a World Series. But, yeah, Tanyan Sturts. Good job by you, Tanyan.
Yeah. Thanks for your contribution. It looks like Brooks Kieschnick made his debut. You mentioned that earlier, maybe. Mm-hmm. Or you mentioned Robin Jennings, Ozzie Timmons. It was a mess. It was, you know, it went perfectly, it feels like, according to the folks at the Tribune boardroom. You know, it was not a bad team. I mentioned it. If we're going to finish, I just want to reference this because I know that this happened, and I'm just going to find the game. I'm going to trouble everybody to look this up if they're so inclined. But this is a mediocre team. This is not a team that we would consider a contender. Like, you know the real contenders as soon as you hear them. 84, 89. 98, even 01, even though they didn't do it, that was a legit contender. 03, 04, even though you hated them, they were a legit contender. 07 and 08 made the playoffs, and that's pretty much it for the pre-Epstein years. But there are other years where they were kind of alive. Even 95, I know they were technically not eliminated to the last, you know, second to last season, but I don't really consider that legitimately in it. And I don't consider the 96 Cubs legitimately in it, but it could have sort of happened. And when you're watching it, you're still holding out hope. So even this mediocre team that you pointed out, the monthly record, Andy, they're plodding along a couple games over 500 in June, a couple games over 500 in July, in August, and they find themselves in September. And I just remember this: I'm in my apartment. You know, within my first year of living in Chicago. I've had a hell of a summer. You know, I'm, you know, getting out to games and doing this and that, and everything's, you know, if only the Cubs can relive that magic from 1989. Because, again, at this point now, it's been 7 years. It would be a couple more till they would get there again. But they go into a game on Tuesday, September 17th. And I hate to do this because it's a fucking Cardinals game. But we just need to, you know, encapsulate this season the right way, just to sort of put some punctuation on it. You got a Cubs team that heading into the game is 500 on the nose. So 74, 74 and 74. And going into the game, the Cardinals are 80 and 70. So it's, you know, not exactly, you know, the Cubs are a long shot. Like I said, they were not legitimately, in fact, going into this game, or, you know, at the end of this game, it turned out the Cubs would only be six games back. So going in, they're five out. So whatever. The math says you're alive. You're five games out. You got a three-game series in St. Louis. I know it's a tall order, but you sweep that series, and all of a sudden, you know, we're going nuts in a way that Mike Royko might even approve, because at that point, we would have been three games over 500. So in this game on September 17th, your starting pitchers are Frank Castillo, who actually pitched a very good game in spite of a tough season, and future Cub Donovan Osborne, who had a pretty good year for the Cardinals that year. Cardinals take a 1-0 lead in the bottom of the fourth. Cubs tie it in the top of the sixth. And the manner in which the Cubs tied it was our good friend Scott Service, who delivered a two-out single to right. So it's very tense. And I remember watching this game in my apartment. So what happens is the 1-1 game goes all the way to the top of the eighth. Okay, again, Cubs are five games out coming in, first game of the series. Mark Grace leads off, gets a single left field. The aging Ryne Sandberg, who has really kind of struggled through this season, but he's, you know, he's over 20 home runs, steps up against future Cub Donovan Osborne and fucking launches a two-run homer in the top of the eighth. Cubs are up. And God bless Ryne Sandberg, son of a gun. He's, you know, done it again against the Cardinals, especially in a game that counts, two-run lead. So we go to the bottom of the eighth. Cubs are six outs away from a huge first game of the series. Former A Mike Gallego gets a hit off of Frank Castillo. Castillo's still in the game. So, of course, it's a different time because there's no way the starting pitcher would still be in the game at this point. Future White Sox, Royce Clayton flies out, though, to right field. That's it. Riggleman comes out. Relieves Castro, gets in our friend Bob Patterson, who had to put down somebody's glove that he was stitching. Patterson comes in. Here comes Ozzie Smith, another middle infield Hall of Famer. Okay, not going to say anything more about that. Ozzie was a great defensive shortstop. And then Ozzie, to answer Sandberg, hits a triple down the right field line to tie the fucking game. Ray Langford hits another triple. Cardinals win. Cardinals end up getting another run. But it was just, I remember like watching it in real time. And it wasn't cool because it was painful. Because I wanted, more than anything, I wanted the Cubs to win. But I was kind of able to appreciate, like, holy shit, here's Sandberg, who's kind of done. You know, at this point, the jury was in. His comeback was okay. He's going to come back again in 97. It would only get worse. He has a huge home run, and that should have been – that would have been a great story. It would have been something. And then fucking Ozzy, credit where credit's due, son of a bitch, gets the big hit. So two guys that eventually end up in the Hall of Fame, two middle infielders, late in their careers. I don't even know how much longer Ozzy played, but had huge plays in that game. That was it. So it was probably one of the last big hits that fucker had. He didn't have that many to begin with because he got in the Hall.
We know he didn't get any in the last three games of that NLCS that year.
Oh, let's finish with that, Andy. Now that I just took us down, only I wanted to share that memory because it was poignant, even if it was painful. But let's just remember that after that point, then the Cubs just fucking didn't care because that's when they lost, as you said, the 17 out of 19. This may have started it. So they were within five games in the last 3 weeks, and then it didn't matter. And by the last weekend of the season, it was done. In the playoffs, the Cardinals break what in our lifetime I think was their longest streak of not having made the playoffs since they went to the series in 82. They reached this newfangled division round against the Padres in 96, having not been to the playoffs since losing the Twins in the 87 World Series. So they've been out for 9 years. They knock off the Padres.
Yeah, it's future Cubs Scott Sanders.
Yes, that's right. And then we mentioned this before. They go up 3-1 against the Braves and end up losing the last three games. I think I'm not even exaggerating. I think it was a 29-3 or something like that.
It was great.
And so it's safe to assume Ozzy ended his career just gently flailing at garbage pitches by Glavin, Smoltz, and not garbage pitches, but pitches in the dirt.
So now one guy we didn't mention, the left fielder of the 1996 Cubs, Luis Gonzalez, who had come over the year before in the Rick Wilkins trade with Scotty Service.
Yep.
And had a solid year for the Cubs, 271, 354, 443. Wasn't flashing a lot of power in those days, 15 homers, 79 RBIs.
Yep.
He went free agent after the 96 season, went back to Houston, which I didn't remember. Played one season there.
I remember that.
Spent a year in the abyss in Detroit, where he hit, for the first time in his career, he hit 20 homers.
In that short pour. That was second to last year at Old Tiger Stadium. Okay.
Then he went to Arizona, and I don't know if it was if he got into Pilates or maybe free weights. I don't know, but he hit 26 homers, 111 RBIs, career highs in both. The next year, 31 homers and 114 RBIs. And then in 2001, when the Diamondbacks won the World Series, he hit 57 homers and drove in 142 runs.
What happened?
Huh. Yeah. Because a lot of guys at 33 finally mature into their bodies and hit 57 home runs.
Oh, yeah. Just go through history.
Yeah.
Like Johnny Mize probably had a rheumatoid arthritis at 33 after already hitting. Like who starts doing that at 33? So, yeah, 15 homers for the Houston in 93. His years with the Cubs, he was a 12 to 15 homer guy.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden.
57.
Yeah, 57.
I mean, this side of Brady Anderson, that's one of the more ridiculous
Yeah, that
anomalies.
Was basically like all the other steroid guys are like, oh, come on, man. Come on. But half the dosage. Would you? You're making us all look bad. 57?
Yeah, he went from being like a useful left fielder for the Cubs. He was a useful guy, right? He was a fine player. He's smooth.
Yeah,
he was a good outfielder. He's going to bat 275. He'll get on base.
He was the guy he replaced. He was a right-handed Derek May.
Yes, with a little bit more power and maybe health. Yeah, yeah.
He was a better outfielder. Anybody was a better outfielder than Derek May. But so the Cubs are like, that's okay. You can go. And then just five short seasons later, he's third in MVP balloting, wins a World Series, gets a game-winning hit in a World Series.
It's incredible. It's funny when you look at that Cubs roster and you just see, like I was doing it earlier, you see Grace and you see Sosa and an old Sandberg. Luis Gonzalez doesn't even register because I'm seeing that it's Luis Gonzalez on the Cubs, and to me it's always just this sort of guy. Yeah. He's just a guy. So kudos to you, Luis Gonzalez, and all of you 1996 Cubs. I think we've
covered. Luis made such an impression in 96 that the Cubs replaced him with Doug Glanville in 97.
Well, Glanville, Brant Brown. They didn't really have
really a plan. Everybody. Everybody played left field for the.
It's funny how the bottom continued to drop, actually. When you look at the 17-19 finish.
It just kept going. So at one point.
They lost 17 out of 19. And then they lose the first 14 games of last year. So at one point, they lost 31 out of 33 games. Do I have that right? If you carry it over, and it was mostly the same team, they didn't really do anything.
Jim Riggleman in his Cub career had 2 50-game stretches where the team won 20 games.
You mentioned that.
Think about getting a chance to do that a second time and pulling it off. Congratulations, Jim. Attaboy.
Well, and the fact that he, before Joe Madden, was the longest serving Cubs manager in our lifetime. Somehow he positioned that 98 wildcard team perfectly, because I'm sure both 20 and 50 or whatever. You say they went 20 and 50, two different 20 and 50 stretches?
Yeah. I don't remember exactly when they – one of them was this. This was the end of
– Yes, it had to have been, yes, obviously.
It's obviously one. And the other one was
– 99 after 99. That high point when – was almost like the 77 Cubs in this year's Cubs where they were like – 11 above in early June, and then after Tyler Houston had that big homer,
yeah, it went south super hard.
Well, yeah, so yeah, Jim Riggleman riding the L to work, getting laid more than most managers.
Jim Riggleman took the L twice most days, three times.
That's the perfect way to end that. That's great.
All right. Well, we'll see what the wheel says next week, but that's the 96 Chicago Cubs.
Sayonara.
What a bunch.
Many of us have herpes.